Like, what are the odds the following names would have crossed the level one screening of a recruiter today? Steve Jobs, Richard Branson, think of Mr. Larry Ellison, Oprah Winfrey, Michael Dell. What if you go back in time, Mr. Walt Disney or Mr. Ralph Lauren? None of these people would have made past round one in the modern recruitment, stringent recruitment process that we have today. And so it begs the question, are we relying too much on credentialism? Let me simplify that for you. If you don't have a PhD, you don't get a job. If you don't have an engineering degree, then you don't have a job. If you're not an MBA from a premier Ivy League college, then you don't get this role. It's an eligibility criteria. That's how we operate. This is the basic level of people that work here. Are these comments familiar to you? Have you made them? Have you experienced them? Have you been a victim of them? If the answer is yes, this episode is right up the alley for you. This episode, we are going to talk about credentialism, the abuse of credentialism in the modern society, at our workplace, at our everyday sphere, not just at the work. Oh, the person is a PhD automatically means there is a great prospective bride or prospective groom. The person is an MBA from an Ivy League or must be financially viable, so maybe we'll find a better match. If the person is an engineer, then automatically they are most likely to get promoted. Are we holding some of these biases in our society, in our minds? Are we promoting these biases subconsciously? And if yes, what is the impact of this? Is it not true that factories produce more workers than leaders? And is that not the case here in our common workplace where we have increasing number of followers and very little number of leaders? One might argue that you can't have everybody being a leader who will play the cog in the wheel. That being said, is it not true that if everybody is a follower, then we will always look to leadership elsewhere? Homegrown leadership will always be a challenge. Homegrown development will always be a challenge. And if you're promoting a regular worker mindset into a leadership mindset, does that work? Does that work out? Or in many cases, you will realize that you asked someone from outside to come and lead because just you couldn't find someone from in the inside to step up to the role and lead the change. All this and a lot more in this episode of Bus Talk. So buckle up, sit back, relax. If you are stuck in traffic, switch on your headphones and close your eyes. This is going to be a very interesting discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, once again, welcome to Bus Talk. Now, like the example I mentioned earlier, think of these people, Ralph Lauren, Larry Ellison, Michael Dell in the tech space, or Oprah Winfrey, or Ellen DeGeneres, or any of these leaders, Azim Premji, closer home. All these leaders are just simply brilliant leaders in their own professions, in their own rights. But were they the same when they started out? So it leads me to believe that we have this illusion of meritocracy, which is predefined in our heads. Like we have this unconscious bias that is crept into a hiring. And that's why when I see job descriptions with so much of like a custom tailor shopper's shop kind of a, like a shopping mall kind of a requirement, then it almost defeats the purpose of exploring this raw talent, different talent, which could completely change the way we work. Now, the practical answer or retort to that is, why do we need such people? Why do we need people where, when we are getting so much of, you know, merit-based hiring, where people who come from premier institutes, and you just can't get into premier institutes if you're not good enough, right? Wrong. It's not true. It's not always the case. How many times have we found that people with very wonderful academic backgrounds, and they must have done well academically. I make no mistake, that's another angle to the story. But they don't turn out to be as good a worker or a leader as you originally thought they would be, right? So one is that they might still be academically very good, but that does not always translate to the practical workforce. Like we used to know this leader who was like the classical pedigree all throughout, like end to end, like best schools, best kindergarten to best preschool, high school, everything right up till graduation, post-graduation and everything and beyond. So it's like those, you know, royal resumes, blue resumes, which I say perfect in everything. And so that person did go up the ladder, went up to the highest echelons of management. But did the person turn out to be a great leader? That was a unanimous no. Surprising, isn't it? And then you say, what is a good leader? You're not here to win a popularity contest. Of course, if you take hard decisions, then you are not valued as much by the folks who are impacted by your hard decisions. So how bad is that? I mean, deal with it. Not the case. You know, you don't always need to be a nasty leader to be a successful leader. And so in this particular instance, this person had all the vocabulary, very difficult to talk to because the person seemed to be three steps ahead of you, knows every word that you are about to say. And so people, instead of opening up, started to become closed to this person. And fast forward of a year or two, nobody wanted to work with this brilliance. So it's like the brilliant jerks, as we call them, right? They are so good that they become too good for their own good. They could become too big for their own boots or too good for the organization. But who will bell the cat? Who will bite the bullet? Who will, you know, go out there, stand up and say, we don't think this is a suitable leader? Because there is nothing that you can say. They've already outthought you. They've already out-clip-clapped you. Already out-PPT'd you. And you are stuck in some sense, and many organizations are stuck with such leaders or leadership where they're just not able to shake them off and like, I don't know what to do. So, and then they don't leave till they don't leave. So by the time they do leave, finally, a lot more damage has been done. You probably in the process have lost a lot of good talent along the way, and recovering that is often a big challenge. But my request to all of you listening to this, think of ways to have these conversations. Be careful about having these conversations about what should be the organizational leadership culture. You have always heard about organizational culture, but what is the organizational leadership culture? What is the sentiment you're trying to bring to the table? Not just for the optics or the tokenism or anything of that sort, but real, authentic leadership. Do we stress that enough in conversation? Like, be authentic, be open about it, come down to a level where the lowest common denominator understands what you're trying to do or what you're trying to say. Are you relatable? Are you reasonable? If the answer is no, it does not matter what credentials you bring to the table. You have not been able to connect to the organization as a leader. And so if you do not connect as a leader, then merely directing them does not always lead to double-digit growth, does not lead to accelerated growth. It just meanders and flows till board comes together and figures out, well, now we have to do something different. Think of the Steve Jobs saga. Think of so many other leaders who tried what they did, what they could in their earlier stint, but finally when they came into their own being, their true self emerged. Very little has to do with what their credentials were at the time. They had to almost lose all their previous credentials and reset, restart, and find the real leader in them. And rest, as they say, is history. So experience versus degrees. Now, this debate has been raging for a very long time. And it cuts both ways, right? On one hand, there is no compression algorithm for experience, right? There is that much that you can show in terms of degrees. On the other hand, there are also instances where people have no degrees and they have a ton of experience, but they're not scaling up because it's become self-restricting. Oh, I only know this. This is the only experience I have. And so we meander into the conversation around experience versus ability. Do degrees get you more ability? That's a question to think. I don't have the answer to that. Do you think just because you have a master's degree from a premier institute gives you more ability? It gives you more information, all right. It gives you better soft skill, all right. But does it necessarily mean that you will deliver more than the one who does not have a master's degree? Or someone who has a regular degree from a regular, less famous college, as it were. These are the entire diaspora, the entire leadership spectrum is filled with instances, is replete with instances where there are leaders who have come from almost nondescript background situations, academics, who've gone on to be brilliant leaders and change the fortunes of the company. Now, on the other side, people might also argue, well, if I've done my engineering, I've done my business school degree from a premier institute, are you assuming that I'm not a good leader? Have we not made changes? Have we not made intelligent decisions to move ahead? The answer is both yes and no. There have been enough examples where people with pedigree backgrounds have made an impact. And you cannot deny that, you cannot ignore it. But the question is, why is it then it is considered a safe bet over those people who have delivered via their experiences? Why are we dismissing the other off is the question. If you give them equal footage, and I've never said that it should be one in lieu of the other, I'm saying, why not have an equal mix of people with experience, people with degrees, people with degrees and experience, people with no degrees and experience, people with less experience and less degrees, people with more experience and more degrees? Can we not have a healthy mix? I mean, some HR folks will say, yeah, we already do have such a mix, but the biases that creep in are far in number in my limited view. Biases meaning, if you just all you have to do is just look at some of the jobs published today in any of the top job portals, and you will find every single job description having a specific educational requirement from a premier institute. Most of them specify, I want folks from IIT, IIM, I want folks from XYZ. In fact, some of the job descriptions even go a step ahead and say, I want to only hire people from these companies. I mean, like, look at the myopic nature of that you're completely ruling out a top talent from folks who don't work in one of these top companies or top institutes or who come from some of these things. Is that not a bias that you're propagating into the market? Imagine the impact, right? So, and therefore this is vicious cycle, the impact on this on the education system. So all the parents think, if I somehow take an education loan for my child and put them through the top premier institutions, my financial woes for the rest of my life are taken care of. So education becomes the sole focus on elevating social status from, say, level A to level B or level 1 to level 2. Whereas the learning of it takes secondary seat. Why are you doing an MBA? Well, I will get more salary. That's a common answer I get all the time. But are you not doing an MBA to understand new strategies and newer ways to solve problems and put some method to the madness? Well, yeah, that too will come. Isn't that obvious? But the first prompt reaction is, why did you do your engineering? Well, because my father said so, because my mother said so. And I'm like, yeah, but what is it that you wanted to do? Well, I wanted to be an artist. And I'm like, so what stops you from being an artist? No, I don't think there's enough money there. I mean, it's much more harder to earn money being an artist than being an engineer. So I'd rather be a mediocre engineer than be a struggling but brilliant artist. And that's the so-called reality back justification that people do within the society, owing to this credentialisms that, oh, once you are highly educated and highly qualified, then automatically you get high paid jobs and then rest will figure out. Strictly speaking, is it wrong to think like that? Is it wrong to expect that, well, if I've secured the best degrees from the most premier institutes, what's wrong in expecting a higher salary? The question is, why are they getting a higher salary? Why is an MBA degree from a premier business school attracting a bigger salary than a non-premier one? Is it because you get better products? That is a debatable question, isn't it? Because there have been brilliant leaders from non-premier schools as well. So then why again you're just paying more for the brand and you are looking at a better return of investment, that you spend hundreds and thousands of dollars towards getting this degree from this premier business school. And then so the return of investment will be in 3 years' time versus non-premier, which might take 10 years' time. What is the impact that you are bringing to the society? What is the assumption? What are the biases that you bring to the table that, yeah, just because you've been around the block in some of these named institutions, you automatically become this, uber hero, which is in reality not the case. So that is the challenge with these subconscious biases owing to credentialisms. Next, networking and nepotism. Meritocracy suggests that promotions and opportunities are solely based on individuals' abilities. However, in many workplaces, networking and connections play a crucial role. Individuals with influential connections or those benefiting from nepotism might advance their careers, even if their skills are not exceptional. So yes, you've got these credentials, and so you meet someone with similar credentials on the other side and say, oh, okay, we are alumni. Oh, then you must be automatically good. It's my obligatory duty to help you move forward. And therefore you form a cohort of a strong bond. You form a network of people who are promoting similar people with similar mindsets. If you look at it in a separate lens, and I didn't want to use the negative or positive lens, but a different lens, well, talent attracts talent. Brilliance attracts billions. Isn't it? That could be the argument. That what's wrong with attracting more brilliant people who have gone through the same rigor that you have gone through? What's wrong with that? But if you put on a different lens, how dangerous that can be is that if you have managed to get a bad set of values, then you also attract more bad set of values in the organization. And so nepotism creeps in, groupism starts to happen, and that is the bedrock of all failures in organization politics, where Camp A is perpetually fighting with Camp B, arguing, fighting, showing each other down, and in turn, the company suffers. Rarely, we have seen where two competing units excel and take it on in such a way that the company benefits from it. Instead, what we do see, there is bad practices, malpractices that creep in, and then eventually someone wakes up in the upper echelons of management and, you know, diffuses the situation, has to diffuse the situation so that it comes back to normalcy. The amount of bandwidth that it costs, the amount of productivity that is lost, the amount of talent erosion that happens, the cultural impact within the organization, nobody's measuring that. Nobody's thinking about that. It's time, if you're a leader listening to this, if you're a manager listening to this, something for you to reset in your, if you see this around you in your business, that there are people who need to be heard, even if they don't come from similar backgrounds like you do. Like, for example, there is a glass ceiling for minorities. Now, despite commitment to meritocracy certain groups such as women and minorities often face invisible barriers that limit their career progression. This can result from stereotypes, biases, or organizational structures that unintentionally favor certain demographics. There is this unsaid rule that, oh, for this role, we only need these kind of people. They know they have got their hands dirty, so they will be able to do a good job. And it's like horses for courses. But on the other hand, you are eliminating the possibility of a new thought, or someone who can equally compete. Women are always at the receiving end in institutions where they can do much more than what is perceived of them, but very rarely do they get the opportunity. I mean, there is lots of tokenism, there is lots of, you know, patronization and lots of pat on the back. Yeah, you can do it. Come on, we value leadership. There is DEI and everything. Very few actually walk the talk. And so respect to all those leaders and organizations who actively provide a fair platform for women in the organization or minorities to come up the ranks and express themselves and get a chance to showcase their talent and compete on the best possible strategy, compete on the best possible outcome. Nothing wrong with that. But credentialism, sometimes you might argue, what if the same logic of credentialism applies to women? They also come with a lot of credentials backing them. Do we then measure them with the same lens as men? And my answer is yes. Men and women are equal. Those who identify themselves as men and women are, in that sense, absolutely equal employees in an organization, whether they're leaders or in junior management or senior management or individual contributors. And they need opportunities to express themselves independent of the credentialisms. And the problems that men face bringing or abusing credentialisms, the same can happen with women too. So one has to be careful. But suffice to say that more often than not, women are the ones who are sidelined for multitude of reasons within the corporate structure. And so there is enough scope and room for improvement, for rectification, to reset that balance. And so I'd be more inclined to see women rise up to the leadership roles, rise up to challenge the age-old men's credentialisms and say, but there are so many men who probably find it difficult to understand and agree and acknowledge the woman's credentials, despite a stellar track record and background and academics. They find it difficult. And so there is no space for such men in any organization, let alone in the modern organization. I guess if I were to sum this up right, it's the overemphasis on degrees. The word is overemphasis. It's not that you let go of this. It's like some employers continue to place excessive importance on academic degrees, even when the job may not necessarily require such qualifications. And that is where the problem statement is. Can we widen the ring and allow for more voices, more talent to come into the system? Next, ignoring practical skills. Credentialism often leads to a focus on paper qualifications rather than practical skills. This results in overlooking individuals with valuable hands-on on-the-job experience. They have done it, they have walked the mile, they have failed, and that is experience in gold. Their practical knowledge. Folks who've just been recently minted from the MBA factory, they have it on books, they know, well, this is how it happens, it ought to happen. But in practicality, as is often the case, it differs from the books. Because books have been written, say, 10 years earlier, some of the curriculum is not yet updated, and what worked back then and in the rapid space that we changed as a society makes some of those learnings redundant. Like, well, yeah, it, conceptually it worked back then. However, ground realities work very differently. What, for example, give you this example. In all these transitions on technology, when somebody said, well, now everything will be on cloud, those who said no continue to exist at the ground level. So the set of credentials that came along with the people who said so cannot be questioned. Like, yeah, it is true. Cloud is reality. There's no getting away from that. But there was a huge workforce, ground level workforce, which did not believe in that, did not see sense in it. Adoption at the ground level is always delayed from the board level, right? What you discuss at a huddle room inside the boardroom, by the time it hits the ground, it is at least a function of 6 to 8 months, if not more. Adoption, absorption, internalization, these are the things that take time, which are the practical skills. People with practical skills help you bridge that gap. People were still reluctant to move their servers to the cloud because they wanted to have a look and feel and touch of the server. They wanted to feel, where is my desktop? I want to see my server right sitting next to my leg like a pet. How can this not be there? How can it be in the cloud? And guess what? It took a few years of practical skills. So those at the time with, you know, undue pressure coming to them saying that, well, I just said so. Why wouldn't you listen? These conversations were very frustrating because folks with such degrees who did not have practical ground experience found it exceedingly frustrating. It's so logical. Why does it not make sense to you? I mean, it makes so much sense to me, is what they were saying, versus those set of people who probably did not have those degrees. They were like, no, it's my hard-earned investment. I need to see the damn server beside me. Why does that not make sense to you? And so it took a long bridging exercise between the ideal and the practical to merge to a center point and say, yes, we'll have to get moving. And then clearly over time, it changed and people began to, the idea began to snowball, and therefore it settled more easily. And now clearly in 2023, people are that much more open and acceptable to what is cloud, and their lives revolve around cloud, in the cloud. And so sometimes ignoring practical skills is a big challenge with people who have not seen the ground realities, is the net of the story. Next, lack of diversity, over reliance on formal education can contribute to a lack of diversity at the workplace. Closely tied to this point that I made just now, those underrepresented backgrounds may not have the access to certain educational opportunities. They face a lot of discrimination. Is it not incumbent upon a matured society to encourage people without feeling pity, without saying that, oh, let me give you a chance? Not like that. It is like, hey, you might have a point there. Why don't I give you a platform? Is that the tone that we see? Answer is no. Most of the times we don't see that tone. Most of the times they're never heard. Most of the times they're said to shut up and listen. Look at these people who are talking. Just be quiet. And many a times, if the society starts to listen to you, if the underprivileged starts to listen to you at all times, then they forever decline and remain where they are. They don't grow. And so you shrink the talent pool and not expand it. How cool is that? That's absolutely uncool. That is not good, I can say. You have to encourage people to be more inclusive, even if they can't participate actively immediately. But to assume that their cognitive ability is low or their ability to understand is low and they will not, it's a wrong assumption. You have to find the right talent, even with those people who do not necessarily have the same educational background as you do. And the flip side is true as well. People with similar educational backgrounds are not always competent. And so to always assume that they will come up with the smartest ideas and brightest ideas is probably not as accurate either. Next, resistance to change. Credentialism can create resistance to change, with organizations adhering to traditional qualification requirements rather than adopting to the evolving nature of certain roles. Like the cloud example I gave you, you think of any of the new age requirements, right? You need to have empathy, you need to have soft skills, which was probably not the case 15, 20 years ago. I mean, people generally relied on, oh, I have content, so I don't need to worry about the packaging. Now that has changed a lot, where you know, have to communicate, over communicate on what you have. And so packaging has forced its way in and eaten up some of the content, if you will. Where now I often see that there is so much more packaging that the content itself is missing. Like, people are packaging their information so well that when you dig deep, so that there is no content in there. I don't know what's the packaging all about. And these are such extreme dichotomies that without packaging, your content never gets seen. And if you don't have any content, then anyways, you don't stand a chance. And so what is the right balance? And so when people with so much of baggage of their past education, they come into positions of power, positions of influence, they advocate that this is the only way to go ahead, and their vocabulary reflects. It's almost like an icebreaker for every conversation. You will find those people who will introduce themselves as, hey, I did my engineering from here. Where did you do your engineering? I did my MBA from here. Where did you do your MBA? I was like, dude, how does that matter? How does that matter when you're just having a regular social conversation? For them, well, that is social conversation. What's wrong with that? That's a common place to bond and connect, and that's my icebreaker. How did I do in my CGPAs? That's an icebreaker. Oh, God. Well, those who did well generally don't talk much about it. In the sense, those who did get great grades, usually I find that they have not bragged about it. And then there are those rest who were also there and somehow managed to pass and whatever. They usually go to town about, oh, I'm this premier guy from this premier league, without, and I know I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but you do see some of that privileged credentialism reflect in their everyday conversation. It creeps in without any context. You know, back in the engineering days, I used to do this. Back in this MBA days, this, like, well, study the room. If you have a diverse audience who don't come from a relatable background like you do, then is it not sensitive on your part to steer clear of such conversation? In fact, you propagate it and then you put the other person in an embarrassing situation where they say, no, I don't relate. I don't know if that were, you know, to happen, that happened in my case. And so it leads to awkward situations. And so it is incumbent upon people who come with such credentials to be a little more circumspect, a little more careful about who they're addressing. And it can also have a counter impact on the rest of the workforce, because they probably are not as privileged, or couldn't afford it, or were probably as talented, if not better, but they didn't get the platform. And so you are just ignoring a ton of such people out there and thinking that it's my way or the highway. Oh, that isn't that obvious that you should have at least done this this much to be here. And it creates again this classist thing, you know, between a small organization, between a team, where they say that I come from this different class of people, which is counterintuitive, which is counterproductive to organizations, in my view. Next, think of appraisals. You know, when people go through appraisals, the performance evaluation biases can affect how individuals are assessed. We found in some study that identical resumes with male and female names received different evaluations, highlighting how gender bias can influence perceptions of merit. That is something that has happened. But imagine having a credential bias that, well, this person is from XYZ Premier School, but this person is not from XYZ Premier School, then let's offer them a better rating or better increment. How many times such subconscious biases have crept in while appraising people? How does that impact the workforce? It's almost like highest form of discrimination, ignorance and discrimination, where you are separating the workforce because of their academic backgrounds more than what they have delivered at the ground level. In fact, people at job interviews say, oh, this person, we have to give more salary because they come with academic background, which is higher than the average one at the floor. And then the question being, is that good or bad? Is that right or wrong? Is it not about the ability to deliver? And if ability to deliver is the question, then whether the person comes from A, B or C, D does not really matter. Have you evaluated their ability to execute? Where will they be in 6 months' time or 1 year's time, irrespective of their credentials? Have you not analyzed or assessed that? And if not, then why are you assuming and creating a system of people by virtue of their credentials, saying that, oh, they have this, so automatically they form the upper 20% of the compensation structure? And think of this, right? What impact will it have at the workplace? When they step into the system, they automatically carry an air of superiority, that they are better than the best. And what does that do to your attrition levels? What does that do to your team morale? What does that do to your team performance and productivity? Does it increase, boost, or does it divide the team? Or are you saying that that's what you want by design? That let there be disparity. This is capitalism. Not everyone will have everything. So haves and have-nots, creating a ecosystem of haves and have-nots within the organization so that one set will perpetually have not and one set will perpetually have and have more. And so the aspirational will be to become the move from have-nots to have. And so how does that happen? How have you provided that platform where somebody who does not have that credentials has the same salary level as those with those credentials? Answer is no, that's not going to happen. So perpetually, you have kept a distance. And is that a good HR practice? Is that a good business organizational practice? I don't think so. Organizations work well when you focus on delivering the outcome, irrespective of what the input is or where they come from, who they are, who they identify as, what their preferences are, has no bearing on what they can deliver of the given task. And you as an organization, are you spending enough time towards promoting that culture, towards solidifying that platform that, yes, you might be from a premier business school or an engineering school, and we appreciate that. It's not that we want to diss you for that. Absolutely respect you for whatever that you've done. But if somebody has not done that and they still deliver, they have the ability, the talent, the potential to match you, then absolutely we will give them that platform. We will give them that forum to rise and shine. If you have ensured that that is being happening more often than not, I know you can't always have it more often than not, you're still in better shape. The risk is that more often than not, it does not happen. It's a skewed organization completely. And it becomes a very toxic workplace. And toxic workplace never produce good results. Well, that's all the time I had for this episode of Bus Talk. I know this is a very heavy topic, a very deep topic, and there are so many possibilities. I mean, let me just quickly remind all my friends from Premier Business Schools and Engineering Schools, it is not that you are at fault, okay? It's how the system is designed, where the preferential treatment is something that I am not very comfortable with. You might argue that, well, I worked extra hard, I did this, and why should I be penalized for being good in what I am? Idea is not to be defensive about it. Nobody's asking you to be defensive. Idea is to be more inclusive for those people who don't come from a similar background. Can you be more inclusive? Can you be more accepting? Can you be more open? And when you get into a position of leadership, influence, impact, are you being more open? Can I ask you to be a little more open than those with less privileges? That way you will have a healthier workplace, a stabler workplace. People will put in more than what you thought they could. And that's when you know you have a happy company, happy team, and a more progressive team. On that note, give me your thoughts. Send me a note on Twitter, on formerly X. I'm not X now, formerly Twitter. I am available on Ayanisms. That's AAYANISMS. Hashtag Ayanisms. Or you do hashtag Bus Talk. You can send me a note on email or leave me a voice message. If you're on Spotify, just scroll down. There is a poll. Answer that poll and some of your comments will get reflected on the website, and you can check out what others are saying. You can also reach me on email. That's ayanisms@gmail.com, where you can send more long, lengthy conversations if you so wish and desire. We are coming to the end of 2023. It's been a fabulous season four, at least in my view. I will take a break, probably have time to do one more episode, year-ending episode, looking forward to 2024 episode. And then we will take a break before we start on the season five, which is 2024 of next year. Season five of Bus Talk will begin next year, and hopefully I'll get some newer takes. The topics largely remain the same. I can't manufacture and engineer newer management topics, but the learnings increase every year, and I will try and share as much as possible with a fresh perspective, more data, more stories to go. And I strongly recommend that if you haven't heard the previous seasons, please do spend some time and see the evolution of Bus Talk and hear some of your favorite episodes. If you have recommendations on what you'd like to listen to, do drop me a note. On that note, I call it a day. Thank you so much for your time, patience. Have a great year-end celebrations. Be with your family. Stay well. Stay safe. Keep getting your A-game to work no matter what. This is your host, Ayan, and you are listening to Bus Talk.